Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, Conversation with Government Leaders. I'm Paul Lawrence, a partner at PricewaterhouseCoopers and the co-chair of the PricewaterhouseCoopers Endowment for the Business of Government. The endowment was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improve government effectiveness. Find out more about the endowment and its programs by visiting us on the web at endowment.pwcglobal.com. The Business of Government Hour focuses on outstanding government executives who are changing the way government does business. Our special guest tonight is Ray Kammer, Director, National Institute of Standards and Technology. Welcome, Ray.
Thank you, Paul. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, in our first segment, I'd like to find out more about the National Institute of Standards and Technology. I think it's been called the technology infrastructure of our country, but I'd be interested in you explaining more about it.
Surely. The National Institute of Standards and Technology is about a 3,300-person agency. We have about $800 million, and our mission is to work with the private sector to grow the economy, improve the quality of life in the United States, and we use three tools. We use measurements, we use standards, and we use technology.
What do you mean by each of those three?
Well, in the case of measurements, if you think about it, to have commerce as opposed to a barter system, you have to have two things. You have to have a trusted money supply. We don't really have anything to do with that. And you have to trust your system of weights and measures. In the Old Testament, there are eight allusions to weights and measures, and in each case, it appears that somebody was cheating somebody. So it's a historically significant problem.
Okay, well, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about your career. I understand you began with the Department of Commerce 30 years ago, and you've had different positions. Perhaps you could run us through your career.
Sure. I started out as a budget analyst. I became the budget officer of the National Bureau of Standards in those days. I became the chief of staff to the director, director of administration, and then from there I sort of jumped into being acting director of the physics laboratory, associate director, and in 1980 I became deputy director of NIST. The director is a political appointee, so as deputy director I was the chief public servant, if you will. I left NIST a couple of times after I became deputy director, one time to be the chief operating officer of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which was a lot of fun because that's when we were modernizing the satellites and deploying the Doppler radar. And the other time from 1994 to 96, I was chief financial officer of the Department of Commerce, chief information officer, and also assistant secretary for administration. And in 1997, I'm happy to say, the president nominated me at the recommendation of Secretary Bill Daley, and Congress, the Senate, approved me. And since 1997, November, I've been director of NIST. It's the best job in government.
How so?
I get to learn new technologies. I'm obliged to own the most advanced computers and use them, which is something I like very much. I spend about 20% of my time with the staff, visiting with the staff, having them explain to me what they think the technical opportunities of the future are and why they're the opportunities of the future and how we're going to go about doing it. That is just a lot of fun.
Now, you were drawn to public service right after you graduated with your undergraduate degree. So I'm curious, what drew you to public service?
Frankly, it was the local industry. I am fortunate that logging wasn't the local industry or my career would be completely over. What should have drawn me was the opportunity to make a big difference, which you can do in government. And if you're a person like me who enjoys seeing results and enjoys seeing making the society better, government is a good career choice.
And you said there are 3,300 employees at NIST, and I understand, but more than half of them are scientists and engineers, and yet you're not either. How does that affect your ability to lead the organization?
Well, I hold myself accountable for being able to answer the questions what and why with respect to our programs and our program decisions. I don't actually hold myself accountable for how. I like to learn how, and I like to hear from the staff on that, but that's not really my job. Actually, I joke with my friends and peers that helped me run the agency that they're all former scientists. They all got PhDs in some physical science. I'm still using my major. I majored in English. They're no longer using their majors. They're long out of the laboratories.
What are some of the biggest changes you've seen at NIST in the Department of Commerce since you began?
One of the not so good ones is there used to be, I think, a presumption of good intentions on the part of society with respect to government. There's an awful lot more suspicion now, concern that somebody actually wants to do something bad to them. And that's not a good thing. I don't think that's good for our society. Some of the things that have changed that are good things. I think the appreciation for the significance of technology by our society has increased tremendously. The internet itself is a complete game changer. It's changed the way everybody does everything. The speed of technology, 30 years ago, technology unfolded at a leisurely pace. It goes very fast now. Also, people used to work with people just like them. Atomic physicists work with atomic physicists. Now they always work with computer scientists and probably three or four other disciplines.
And how about the challenges to the people managing our government?
I think the biggest challenge is recruiting good people and keeping them and creating an environment where good people want to stay. If you can do that, you can succeed at anything.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, well, what are the challenges? What is it like to recruit and retain at NIST? Because I think that the private sector, as you've indicated, is a particularly attractive alternative to young or junior people beginning their career.
One of the things that's different about NIST than the rest of the government is we have our own personnel system by law. About 15 years ago, we realized that it was taking us 8 months to get through all the approvals in government, and you can't be competitive in the sciences or engineering with that. We now have our system where, worst case, we can hire somebody in 2 weeks. Often we can do it a lot faster than that. We have independent classification authority. All of that makes a big, big difference in hiring people. But even so, at best, we're paying about 0.8 of what a mid-level person would get in the private sector or at a university. On the other hand, we have, as a matter of policy, we buy the best equipment. We encourage you to follow your research where it takes you. We are happy to have you publish. There's no trade secrets. We don't have a teaching load. There is a class of people to whom that kind of a life is very appealing. Every year we hire 60 new postdocs for 2 years. And traditionally in the sciences, people do a postdoc and then perhaps go on to somewhere else or perhaps stay. We get very high quality postdocs and we retain about half of them. And that's our principal method of recruiting our scientists.
Now, you've had a unique career. You explained not only your time at NIST, but also when you were in the Office of Secretary as the acting CFO or the CIO. And I'm just curious how that experience increased your understanding of the role of the secretary, especially vis-a-vis NIST.
I had no idea before I worked downtown for 2 years with three secretaries of commerce. The only problems that come into the office of the secretary are problems that are guaranteed to be virtually insoluble, and yet they must be dealt with. I'll give you an example. We're in the midst of conducting the census, and the 1990 census was the first decennial census where a less good job was done than previously. And the reason is a lot of elements of our society are not comfortable with government anymore. They don't want to be counted. And they don't believe that you're not going to tell the IRS or the INS that they're here. And so they're actively avoiding being counted. And yet, we allocate money to our cities to support social services based on these enumerations. And we're having just a terrible challenge. Congress has said we must do an actual enumeration rather than a statistical estimate. And people don't necessarily want to be counted. The Secretary of Commerce has no choice but to deal with this problem.
So what kind of management skills are needed to operate in an environment with those type problems?
A willingness to make decisions rapidly on quite incomplete information. A willingness to accept responsibility for your decisions and realize that with these kinds of decisions, there is no selection. There is no choice you can make that will please everybody. And indeed, for a high-stakes issue like the census, there's going to be intense feeling. The people that aren't happy with you are going to be very unhappy with you.
And yet it seems like our government was designed to go slow and not make decisions quickly.
That's right. And in a lot of cases, I think that's a good thing rather than a bad thing. The deliberative process needs to be in place. But for operational assignments like the census, like forecasting the weather, you have to move quickly. But those are not policy debates for the most part. At least they're not usually. I think policy debates should be leisurely.
Well, great. And it's time for a break. We'll be right back with more of the Business of Government Hour.